Thank you for attending session 372 titled Mormons, Addiction, and Opioids, Perspectives from Experts and Individuals. Welcome to the closing evening session for Saturday. Following this session, there will be a linger longer pasta dinner and evening storytelling and music with Elna Baker and Mindy Gledhill. Tickets are limited but available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. As you leave tonight, we want to thank you all for coming and being part of the Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine, and by attending our regional conference. Our next conference will be in Frankfurt, Germany. There is nothing like traveling the world with your favorite Sunstone friends. Please join us. Sunstone cannot exist without your financial support. We want to keep this community growing into a healthy, vibrant way to engage Mormonism. Thank you for being a part of that. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. About this presentation, Utah has one of the highest prescription drug abuse rates in the country. How does this affect the Mormon community? Experts and those who have experience with addiction will share their observations and stories. Jeff Johnson is a pharmacist with extensive experience in acute care, community, and long-term care arenas. He currently practices as a financial and supply chain consultant. He's dealt with the realities of substance abuse and addiction in both his professional and personal life. Katanya Johnson is a dedicated student of the social sciences and will soon complete her master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. She plans to practice as a therapist in the field of addiction recovery. Devin Edwards started his 15-year career at DCFS, the Division of Child and Family Services, working on the Child Protective Services team investigating child abuse. Elizabeth Porter attended Ricks College and Utah State University. She is a volunteer with a nonprofit that supplies clean needles to active addicts and a longtime member of a 12-step recovery program. Ryan Watkins is a physician in recovery who has experienced addiction from both sides of the physician-patient relationship. He currently works at a local treatment center helping others facing similar challenges. James Ott is a licensed therapist and family interventionist with a private practice in downtown Salt Lake City. He works with addiction from various frameworks, trauma, family dynamics, mental health, brain chemistry, and so on. He believes everyone should work a daily program of recovery. And so that is a short introduction for myself. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I work with families and individuals with addiction with my private practice. And while I am not in recovery, meaning that I have not suffered from an addiction issue, I do say that I work a program. And the benefit I get from working with people with addiction is that you have to, in order for a person with addiction to stay sober or in recovery, they have to have a high degree of introspection, which forces me as a therapist to do my own work, to do my own introspection. And so that's why I really feel blessed to working with this with these people, with people with addiction issues. So that's kind of a little bit about myself, and I wanted to start with a story here about a friend of mine who had the very typical story of he got injured on his job site, and he went to the doctor. He had to do some surgery on his back. He was given a string of painkillers to take during the after the surgery to help. And, of course, as the story goes, he got addicted to the pain pills. His doctor cut him off. He started buying pain pills on the street and then quickly turned to heroin because it's cheaper. And heroin, you know, you initially smoke it because you don't want to shoot at IV, and then you get a bigger bang for your buck shooting at IV, and so you end up in a series of a pretty short time turning from a person who's following doctor's orders for prescription painkillers to shooting IV heroin. Anyway, after he'd been doing this for a couple of years, and after several unsuccessful attempts to get sober, he decided to go in and talk to his bishop. He thought this was the best course of action. And the bishop kind of, in response to his report of IV heroin use, kind of had that deer in the headlights look and really didn't offer much as a way of getting help. And he left the office feeling really discouraged. And right there was this poster of this statewide emergency preparedness event in case of an earthquake. And this happened over the past weekend. And he had realized that the stake and his stake and as a whole was better prepared to treat an earthquake than a heroin addiction. And this kind of struck him as wrong, and it is very wrong. And while I think the Mormon Church is doing some great steps towards some introductory steps, I'm going to say, towards helping people with various types of addiction, I think it falls far short into what is needed. When we talk about addiction, I want to kind of give a preamble of what addiction is. If you really want to know, you can go to the American Society of Addiction Medicine website, ASAM, and you'll get this really long, comprehensive definition. But John Bradshaw gives a really concise definition, and I want you to think about this. Addiction is a pathological relationship to any mood-altering experience that has life-damaging consequences. So it needs all three of those. Pathological relationship to any mood-altering experience that has life-damaging consequences. And that's really what we're facing when we're dealing with addiction issues. And it goes across the board into the substances, into the process addictions, into a lot of other things. There's a lot of myths of addiction, and for the you who are interested, I actually prepared some handouts with some myths of addiction, ways for family members to help their addictive loved ones, and signs that your loved one may have an addiction. So feel free to come take one afterwards. And I just want to hit a couple of myths. Let me see here. I want to... let me see. Sorry, my handouts got buried here. The myths I really want to hit on is specifically for many, many years in the general population, and I think this is still very prevalent in the Mormon community, people look at people with addiction as having a moral failure. And we know that this is a brain disease. It's also a very complicated network of the reward system and lots of other things, and people can be talking about this. But I want to talk about, I just want to note that it's not a moral failure here. It's not a lack of spirituality. It doesn't mean you had bad parenting. It doesn't mean you didn't have enough faith. Has nothing to do with that. It's also another myth is addiction is an individual problem. I have an addiction, it's none of your business. We know that addiction impacts the individual, but it really impacts the whole family and friend network, as well as even a small community of people. It can impact that whole community in a variety of different ways. Another myth I want to hit on is people with addiction won't get help until they hit rock bottom. They've got to be willing to get help. They've got to hit rock bottom. This is a very dangerous myth. Think about if we had this myth with people with a heart disease, right? We don't want to intervene with somebody. It's your business. You have really high cholesterol and bad triglycerides, but we're not going to talk to you about this until you have a heart attack, right? Then you've hit rock bottom, and then you'll be ready for help if you're not dead. And there's some others that you're welcome to come up and read, but these are all myths and fallacies that really set people up for lack of support, lack of getting help, and really at risk of death. I also want to talk a little bit about some signs and symptoms of addiction. Basically, what I really want to touch on is we know our loved ones, and if people are consistently engaging in strange, different behavior that's abnormal, whether that's mood, personality changes, sudden need for lots of money, characteristic changes, loss of friends, changes in friends, loss of interest in activities. These are all big signs that there's an addiction issue. And the problem is if you go to them and confront them on it or ask them about it, they're going to give you a fairly convincing story that why this isn't true. And so seek professional help. There is professional help out there. I want to also talk about how some of the characteristics of addiction in the Mormon community. One thing, Mormons, I think one reason addiction is so prevalent in the Mormon community is for a number of reasons. One is we're just really bad substance users. There's not really a lot of role models. There's a lot of black and white issue. We don't have people drinking responsibly that we see this in our community. And so also with the guilt and shame of the word of wisdom and of the church culture, you know, we have a lot of people that if they're going to drink one beer, they're going to drink 10. You know, if you're going to suffer that guilt, suffer it well, right? And so that's a big, huge issue is the black and white. We also don't see addiction as a spectrum. We don't see it from kind of recreational use, misuse, abuse, and dependence. We see either you're sober or you're an alcoholic, right? We have a lot of trust in authority figures in our culture. We tend to trust people and trust authority. Doctors, as good as they are, as well-intentioned as they are, they don't get a lot of training nowadays into how to treat addiction. And I think that many doctors and prescribers are treating this the best they can, and we're taking substances or prescription medication as prescribed, but this can turn into an addiction, and we need to take some responsibility for what we're doing here and what we're putting into our bodies, because a drug is a drug is a drug. And the last piece I want to talk about is that we tend to be in our culture really addicted to opiates and benzodiazepines or those anti-anxiety medication, Valium and Xanax and this sort of thing. I quite often run into people who will never have touch a drop of alcohol or drink a cup of coffee, but are physically addicted to these medications. Again, just that's kind of part of the culture. The last thing I want to talk about is again, going back to that addiction definition. One thing I often see in the Mormon community is addiction to service. And let me explain. A lot of the reason why people are addicted is because they're trying to numb or distract from an internal pain. They're having a spiritual deficit. And so if we go out and drink and drug, it does that numbing and it does that distracting, but in the next morning we have a physical and a spiritual hangover. We have all that guilt and shame from doing that. But as Mormons, we're really good at performing acts of service. We're really good at doing our church calling and doing it extra well and in a sense encompassing our life with doing good deeds, but we're doing it for the wrong reasons. We do it as ways to distract and numb from our own internal deficits, and we're not doing the introspection we need. But the problem is when we're done with this, we feel good about ourselves, right? And so this is how I think we can get really caught up into our service addiction with the LDS community. Anyway, that's all I've got. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. And we're going to have a Q&A after each of us get finished. So save your questions, and we're really excited to be here. Thank you.
All right, thank you, James. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm a pharmacist. I grew up here in Salt Lake City. I spent most of my career in pharmacy working for Intermountain Healthcare, kind of the behemoth system here in the Valley. I'm not with them anymore. Anyhow, I want to get into some statistics and maybe some of the science behind opiates, why they're so addictive, you know, why this crisis has come about. But first, I figured I should tell my own story. So I grew up here in Salt Lake in Murray. I've kind of battled substance abuse my whole life. The first time I remember using, I was 11, I was in the fifth grade. It scares the crap out of me because I have children that age now. But it was a time in Salt Lake where it was always on the news that kids were dying from huffing airplane glue. And I thought, why on the earth would you want, you know, why would you want to huff airplane glue? There's got to be a reason. So me and some friends tried it. And I remember everybody kind of laughed and tried to catch their breath, and everyone ran off. But not me. I kept right on going. I didn't know what it was doing to me, but I liked it, and I just couldn't stop. So up until October 7th of 2015, that's my sober date, almost 2 years. I bounced around from periods of occasional sobriety to periods of pretty heavy drug use, from everything now, alcohol to really whatever I could get my hands on. And then, you know, I my wife and I, who we'll talk in a moment, we started using together when we first started dating. Long story short, eventually we ran out of drugs, we ran out of money, ran out of hope. And our world fell apart. We were fortunate. We're still alive. Well, we didn't lose our kids. You know, it was really tragedy, and it could have certainly been worse, but it was tragedy that really kind of, for me, kicked me out of that cycle of addiction. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a big fan. I've never been to LDS 12-step, but I hear it's good. I just found what works for me, and I love AA. It's awesome. Okay, statistics. So the Kaiser Family Foundation is a group that keeps statistics on prescription drug use and some other health things. So in 2016, the highest prescription drug per capita amount, I guess, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but the states with the highest prescriptions per capita, Kentucky and West Virginia at 20. So every person on average gets 20 prescriptions per year. The average is about 12.9. Utah comes in, believe it or not, at 9.5. So in terms of just prescription drug use, you know, we're below average. Of those prescriptions, 8.3 for the average male and 12.4 per year for the average female. Between the ages of 18 and 44, this is from the CDC, between the ages of 18 and 44, the most commonly prescribed class of medication is an analgesic or a painkiller. So it's opiates, more so than cholesterol medications or blood pressure medications. It's opiates. It's painkillers. There are 91 opiate-related deaths per day in the United States. In Utah, there are 86 opiate prescriptions per 100 people per year. So we all almost get one per year. And when you think we have a low overall prescription drug utilization, but we have a pretty high opiate utilization, so you can see that there's a lot of them being used out there. Of the 91 opiate-related deaths per day, Utah is the fifth highest state in the country. We have almost two per day. The average age of those people that are dying is 23.4 years old. But there are deaths in all trackable age groups from opiate overdose. And we also have the highest rate of overdose deaths among service veterans is in Utah. Another interesting fact from the CDC, 80% of heroin users started with prescription opiates. So what is it about these drugs that are so addictive? Well, really, there's two factors. There's physical dependence, and then there is, you know, addiction, which is really a combination of physical dependence and psychological dependence as well. So the way these drugs work, you know, our bodies use neurotransmitters and chemicals to communicate between nerves. One of those neurotransmitters called substance P. It's easy to remember because P for pain. And it's released by nerves when there's some sort of trauma. So damage or tissue damage or even some emotional damage can cause release of substance P. But it's a response to painful stimuli, and it causes the sensation of pain. It contributes to inflammation. It also causes depression and anxiety. Opiates prevent those nerve cells from releasing substance P, but they don't affect the production of substance P. And you can actually see this under a microscope where these nerve cells will just swell with substance P that they can't release, but it's still there. Another part of the physical dependence is opiate receptor downregulation. That's a mouthful, but what that really means is when you have high levels of opiates in the blood, the sites on the cell that the opiate will bind to once it's in your bloodstream, your body says it's got too many, and it starts taking those away. So what that leads to over time is a decrease in the effective dose, or rather, they lose their effect. So a dose of opiates becomes less effective over time. That's why you'll hear people say they have a tolerance for opiates. They can take a ton of them without any negative effects. But also, you need a higher dose to maintain the relief or to maintain the effect of the medication. I say this next statement with love, so I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way. This is just a fact of life. Physical dependence to opiates will develop within 7 to 10 days of use, 7 to 10 days of regular use, 100% of the time. There are no exceptions, even if you're, I don't know, living right, bishop, whoever, no exceptions. You will become physically dependent in 7 to 10 days because opiates are no respecter of persons. Addiction, so folks that are addicts have that same physical dependency on these on opiates, on the chemicals, but there's a psychological component as well. The body's reward system, which really evolved, I guess, as a way to encourage us to eat and procreate, is through chemicals called dopamine. You take pleasurable experience releases dopamine. You get a rush from things like this. People become dependent on that rush. Also, opiates are often taken as a way to escape. You know, substance P can cause anxiety and depression. You take opiates, you don't feel those things. It's a way to escape anxiety. It's a way to escape the hard things in life, and to just numb yourself kind of the outside world. One key difference or way to think about the two, the most important thing in an addict's life is the next dose. I mean, you can tell an addict, like a toddler with a cookie, say, if you leave this cookie alone for now, I'll give you two later. They're going to take the one that's in front of them right now, and an addict will act the same way. Talk really quickly about withdrawals. So we're thinking about how opiates work. They block the release of that chemical, substance P, but they don't block the production of it. So withdrawals from opiates are often based on that. They're incredibly painful. I'm sure others on the panel will can agree, but insomnia, anxiety, hallucinations, depression, nausea and vomiting, pain head to toe that you can't describe. It's misery. It's misery. But it can be greatly reduced with the help of a good physician, significantly reduced. I mean, it's going to be miserable at least a little bit, but we can make it a heck of a lot better. Practicing pharmacy in Utah in regards to the opiate crisis, you see a lot of addicts that are not addicts. And by that I mean a lot of people who have lost like 18 grandparents in the last 6 months, and that's why they always need their prescription a few days early. Or a lot of cats and dogs that eat a month's supply of Percocet. But no cat or dog has ever died from eating a month's supply of Percocet. People that need help, but they won't. Either they don't know how to get it, or they're not yet willing to look. And I think it's really more they don't know how to get it. My darling mother still doesn't know my history of substance abuse. I've tried to bring it up with her, and she doesn't want to know. Doesn't want to know. That's what she'll say. She'll just give me a hug and say, I don't want to know. I'm glad you made it. It's just not something we talk about. Now, if you are a loved one, if you feel you may be dependent or you may be an addict, some important things to keep in mind. You are not weak. You are not a bad person. You're not amoral. You haven't sinned. These drugs will get everyone who uses them, everyone. It's not that you have bad character. It's just the way the drugs work. It is what it is. There's hope. We do get better. There's, like I mentioned, AA, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, and ways that we can improve. But my hope really is that we can, as a community, we can start to talk about these things and remove the shame. You know, there's no shame in saying that you need help. Anyhow, I'm going to have a seat. Thank you very much.
about that. All right, so I'm going to take a turn for the left, you know, not following their lead necessarily. But for me, in this topic of the church and how addiction is addressed, it really makes me a little upset because I feel that it's not talked about and it's not something that's appropriate to talk about. So for me, I started using when I was 12, and I didn't get sober until I was 30. And that's a long time to be hiding it. And I had a fairly successful life. I mean, I was able to hide it what I thought was well. But I think that I hurt a lot of people along the way. And I think it would have been better if I were able to talk about it. And I had parents, like right now, my dad's a bishop. My family's very active in the church. And their response to me would always be like, just stop taking them. Just stop taking your meds. And that was it. They didn't understand. And I also suffer from depression, and they would say, just be happy. And it just doesn't work like that. And to be able to talk about it and have an environment where I felt comfortable would have been really awesome. So what I brought today is, it's called an impact letter. And it kind of describes, it's something that you receive when you're in treatment. And I was in treatment for 97 days at the Chateau in Midway when, Jeff spoke about, when our whole life fell apart, that's what happened. I ended up going to treatment, and he had to stay home and continue working and watch our six children. So this will give you a really in-depth look at what addiction looks like and what how ugly it is, I guess. So I'm just going to read it to you. Okay. I wrestled with how, and this is coming from Jeff. This is his letter to me when I was in treatment. I wrestled with how to approach the writing of this letter, whether it should be written in generalities or if it's best to cite specific examples and incidents that illustrate the cost of your drug use, that your drug use extracted on me, our children, our finances, and our relationship. I decided it best to provide a mixture of both to completely illustrate the situation. The first feelings that come to mind are an embarrassment, embarrassment and a measure of shame. You take oxycodone and Xanax and perhaps Ambien as well, and you'd get so groggy it was evident to anyone that you were under the influence of something. This happened several times at game night in Tooele, where you'd pass out on the floor in the middle of games. It was happening while watching UFC fights at Jen and Dan's home. Our friends, people who love and care about you and your well-being, all expressed concern for you, and I was left to cover up the truth, tell them that you were just overly sleepy or that you had had a long day, and as you lay drooling on their floor. When the time came to leave, you'd often have trouble walking to the car. Something similar occurred during a very intense and important conversation with your mom and dad when they were threatening to kick us out of their home. Their concerns were that your drug use had made you combative, and it exacerbated fights with your mother and limited your interaction with the children. They were concerned that while you spent days lying on the couch, the kids were unattended and damaging their home because you were too high to care for them properly. As they were presenting their concerns, your eyes started to roll back into your head. You struggled to focus your gaze on anyone for more than a few seconds, and you were drifting in and out of consciousness. You were completely unable to participate in the conversation. This left me in the very awkward position of having to cover for you. No, it's not the drugs. She's just overly tired from watching the kids all day, or maybe she has a bug or something. She's just super sleepy. Frankly, your parents were right. Your drug use became more important to you than time with your kids. You'd move furniture around so Harvey couldn't get into the downstairs kitchen, but beyond that, there wasn't much interaction with him or any of the kids. Being pregnant didn't stop the drug use either, neither with Harvey nor Aria. During your pregnancy with Harvey, your doctors tried to get you off opiates completely, but ended up greatly reducing your dose. And when that dose wasn't enough for you, you'd get your prescription written early. We'd avoid certain pharmacies and claim we didn't have insurance. And several hundreds, if not thousands of dollars later, you would have what you needed. I had forgotten about this, but the doctors at UVRMC were concerned about Harvey being addicted to opiates and withdrawing. He wasn't held overnight, but there was concern for him. After Harvey was born, when you were pregnant with Aria, my back first got bad. I ended up on opiates as well. When you started running out, you'd ask me to provide you with pills from my prescription. I admit I didn't say no, and I should have, but when I tried to tell you no, you'd almost always explode at me, and I remember you waking me up early one morning screaming at me that I was a liar and should do what I was promised. You had burned through your prescription from your doctor and were withdrawing, and I knew, and you knew if you treated me poorly enough, if you attacked me hard enough, I'd give in, and I did. I had 3.5 tablets left with over a week before my next refill and gave you 2 of them. I didn't sleep for 3 nights. Every part of me hurt in ways I had never experienced and hoped to never experience again. And you slept like a baby. You didn't care about how your actions affected me or Harvey or anyone else, as long as you got your fix. Most nights when I'd get home from work, it followed a pattern like this. I'd walk in, you'd be angry. I'd ask what was wrong. You'd tell me nothing or the kids or something. And within a few minutes, you'd be asking me for pills. And I'd give them to you, scared to tell you no and preferring to avoid the conflict. Then we'd hop in the car, drive around for hours on end while you'd smoke and stare at your phone. I don't even think you knew I was there or that it mattered. You didn't because you were medicated and out of the house. Things again got worse while pregnant with Aria. Your doctor decided enough was enough and he couldn't continue refilling your narcotics early. You used more and more and interacted with people less and less. We'd fight on occasion, usually because I felt I wasn't appreciated. The truth of the matter is that your actions made me feel like I served only 3 purposes: to provide you with drugs, to provide you with money, and to buy whatever you wanted, including more drugs, and to keep the house from falling apart. I did the dishes, the laundry, helped the kids with homework, tidied up the basement, tried to keep our bedroom livable. You took your meds and played on your phone. One of the lowest points of all this was being told that we had to leave the hospital without our baby girl because her opiate withdrawals were too severe. Knowing that those withdrawals, knowing what those withdrawals are like, it's hard to imagine our precious girl suffering so much because you couldn't stop and I couldn't tell you no. You became withdrawn from everyone and everything. After we moved, you'd stay in our bedroom for hours on end, or you'd sit in the car or go shopping. But your time was spent alone, away from the kids, and you and I were together. You and I were together, were rarely connected unless drugs were involved. And then the prevailing pattern was still to drive in circles for hours while you played on your phone in silence. I felt like a paycheck and a maid. Your schoolwork started to slip when you found a new doctor who would prescribe anything you wanted. You spent hours doing nothing, and as the deadline came close, it was anybody's fault but yours, usually mine. That your assignments weren't done. Even when I'd write things for you, it was still my fault that things hadn't got done. When you didn't pass that portfolio class, it was like you let go of the ladder and started a long fall. From the point of view of your husband, I could tell you you just didn't care about anything. I was watching you chase excitement. You'd find some Lego or hobby or book and obsess over it and then move on to the next for a handful of days. The one constant was using oxycodone in ever-increasing amounts. You were so angry when your new doctor cut you from 150 tablets a month to 120. You said that 30 tablets a month is a lot. You can't just cut me 30 a month. I don't think you realized, or maybe you didn't simply care, but you were taking far more than 30 tablets a month from me. My pain didn't matter. If I was withdrawing or unable to sleep, you didn't care. It didn't occur to you that while you had a comfortable bed to lie in when withdrawing, I was in a pharmacy surrounded by professionals trying to hide what was going on, spending 8 to 12 hours on my feet. Some of the worst moments before the crash were seeing how scared the kids were when you had been at the store for hours and Harvey managed to escape. I can't imagine the misery of losing him. The day I found you unconscious in the car, you had no idea how you got there, how long you'd been there. Aria was in her crib screaming, and Harvey had destroyed the house. We had moments of joy and happiness and love. I harbor no ill will or hard feelings and accept responsibility for my part in everything. I'll just stop there. But that gives you some insight into what the life of an addict looks like and the damage it causes to everyone and everyone that loves you. And, yeah, that's all I have for right now.
Hi, I'm Devin Edwards. I'm a therapist down in Carbon County. Carbon County is, as you've already heard, our state has a big problem with opiate use. In Carbon County, we are number one in opiate overdose death and addiction rates per capita. So it's a pretty common issue, and we have a very small clinic of about 8 dedicated people that are battling this with little to no outside support than that. So this has devastated our county, it's devastated our state, and it has no boundaries, has no limitations on who it can affect. I started my career with DCFS 12, 13 years ago. I did child abuse investigations. I worked with in-home families where that were in the recovery process, as well as foster care, where we worked with children and families to reunify children back into the home after a drug abuse situation. In that 10-year span I was there, I don't believe I worked any case that wasn't involved with drugs in some way. But over the last 10 years I've been there, it's really shifted on what the drugs of choice have been. When I first started my career, we'd rarely heard of heroin use. It wasn't very popular at the time. Meth was the main drug we were doing investigations on and getting positive tests back for. And over the last 5 years, that has completely shifted, and now it's heroin, which seems to be even more deadly and more addictive than methamphetamine. For the clients I work with now in mental health, same is true. Opiate use is about everyone we meet with has an addiction to opiate, with the story that comes from similar to what you've heard today, a story where it started out young when they were children and moved through their life, or it's they go to a doctor in good faith, they get injured on the job, which is part of Carbon County, working in a very blue-collar area with our mining. They get injured, they go to a doctor, they believe what the doctor tells them, they feel like they're doing this in good faith, and within 30 days they're addicted and they're buying pills on the street. They're trying to find a way to feed that, because now their brain chemistry has changed. They have to, like you've heard, every part of their body hurts in the morning. They've become dependent on a substance so quickly they didn't realize that they were even getting into it till they were there. And then I think one of our running jokes around our office is addiction is something we can't pray away. And so when people start getting addicted, they might be lucky enough to seek out their bishop, but usually we hide. They hide that addiction. They hide it from their spouse. They hide it from their children, because of the shame involved. They don't want to be seen as weak. And so I think that prevents people from getting treatment at an early stage, and it continues to build and build to where you're getting off the street the medications, and then that becomes too expensive, and heroin's the cheaper alternative. And now we're into shooting up heroin to get a better effect. And it just becomes a very problematic slope that seems to have a similar story with most people I encounter. I would say that a lot of people perceive and misperceive that people who are addicted are weak. I think we heard that a minute ago. And I can tell you in my experience with people struggling from addiction and those in recovery, they're honestly some of the strongest people I've met. They're doing things that I don't know if I could do in my life as far as how this emotionally and physically changes their chemistry, and then being able to stop that and change is amazing. Years ago I was diagnosed as a diabetic, and I still can't give up potatoes. And these people are giving up something that they're chemically dependent on. It's amazing the strength they have to do those things. As far as professionally, I feel like we're starting to change how we perceive drug use and drug abuse and dependence. When I started at DCFS, the common theme was, if they love their children enough, then they'll change. We'll remove their children, we'll take their children away, and this will be the motivator that will change them to make that change. And I'm not a believer of that. I hope I was never was completely. I feel that people that are struggling with addiction still have very strong bonds with their children and people around them. They hurt those relationships, obviously, because they're in a reactionary state. So those can get those relationships can be strained, and a lot of people will withdraw from family and friends that are struggling from addiction because of that pain. And that's really the tragedy of addiction is they become alone when in the moment when they need the most people around them. I've heard recently people talk about the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is community and going out there and getting support and feeling connected. And that is one of the best ways to come through recovery is having that support around you. Anyway, I think that's all I have to say for now. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Liz Porter, and I'm really grateful to be here tonight, for one thing. For another thing, I'm a recovering Mormon, says on my tag, okay, and I'm a recovering addict. I have 26 and a half years clean in a 12-step program, and so I'm here to offer a little hope as well. My story is very similar, except that I did it on the streets of Las Vegas. My dad was a bishop twice over. My mom was the youngest member of a practicing polygamist, so I got it. You know, that's all there was to it. I started using with what was in my parents' medicine cabinet, which happened to be Valium and Paragoric, opioids and antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds. I started using at the age of 6. So I haven't even been clean as long as I used. So the good news is that it can happen. My family disowned me somewhere along the way, except for a few people. One of them is sitting in the audience tonight. I was so glad to see you. And they're the ones that offered me hope. They're the ones that didn't say, because you're LDS, you can pray it away. If you just went to church more, you know, all of these things that you get told when you are in the LDS church and you have a substance abuse problem. None of that works. Taking away my kids, that didn't work either, even though they tried. I was very successful at being a very successful addict for a very long time. I held down a job. My ex-husband went to prison. I paid for all of our stuff. I maintained a home. My daughter went to school every day. Didn't matter that I'd show up at parent-teacher conferences, loaded out of my ever-loving mind, and probably yelling at the principal, which happened. But my family decided, you know, somewhere along the way that I was a bad person. And so they disowned me for, years and years and years. And there were a couple of family members that didn't. They would call me. I would call them. When I'd run away from my home, I would run to their home. And it was just a safe place to be. And it was okay to be who I was. And that was the beginning of the ending of my active drug abuse. I'm not going to tell you it was easy. I'm not a firm believer in drug replacement therapy. Back in the day when I got clean, there were no recovery houses available. If they were, it was way out of my financial ability to pay for it. So I got clean when I had my son. They didn't take him away from me at the hospital. He was one of four babies that were born tiny at a community hospital in Southern Nevada at a teaching hospital. Everybody else lost their babies that day but me. He weighed 3 pounds, 11 ounces. They didn't take him away from me. They let me keep him because I didn't test positive that day. That didn't mean that I hadn't used a couple of days before. It just meant that, you know, I was one of the fortunate ones. And so when I got, when I had that lovely wake-up call, I consider it, you know, my moment of clarity, you know, that moment where I had to make that choice. One of the first people I reached out to was one of my family members that had always accepted me. And I said, look, me and the kids need a place to come and visit, you know, come and stay. I'm, you know, jump ahead a year. I'm a year and a half clean. I've been working my butt off. I've been doing what I need to do. But nothing's working still. You know, my ex-husband just got out of prison. You know, I want to use again. We need a safe place to land. And she opened up her home to me. And she said, come exactly where you're at. So I brought a sick baby, a rowdy teenager, myself, who was struggling with anger issues, and my ex-husband, who had just gotten out of prison, into this woman's home. And she let us stay there. I can't remember for the life of me how long we stayed. We stayed forever. I mean, seriously, we stayed forever. And she asked nothing other than we just suit up and show up. She didn't even ask us to stay clean. Now, I stayed clean. My ex-husband did not. And that has been his story, but that's his story. And if he were here, I'm sure he would tell you. But I stayed clean, and I found a community that accepted me. Now, I'm going to be really honest with you. It wasn't the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church still told me I was a bad person for all the bad things that I had done inside my disease, for all the bad things that I'd done, period. You know, that I was a bad person for shooting dope. In fact, when I first moved back to Utah County and stayed with my family member, I got kicked out of an AA group, sorry, for talking about shooting dope across the podium because it was an AA group. And that's when I realized that I needed to find another community, and I did. I found another community and like-minded people, and we're a bunch of recovering drug addicts. And back in the day when I got here, there were about 8 of us that were solid, and none of us had more than 3 or 4 years clean, but we stuck together. And we went to churches, and we went to you know, recovery houses. By then, they'd started having the recovery houses show up. And we talked about how hard it was to be a Mormon and try and recover from the disease of addiction. And we talked about the ostracization that we felt. And we talked about the lack of communication. And we talked about the lack of education that needed to happen within our religion in order for us to, as recovering addicts, find a safe place to be. And what's been interesting is the dynamic that's happened over the years. I actually was at World Service Conference for Narcotics Anonymous as the representative from the state of Utah about 12 years ago. And a gentleman came from Maryland who was an LDS bishop. And he actually is the one that started the program within the church, the 12-step program within the church. I've never been. I've heard it's good. I work with my bishop on a local level, you know, and there's people in my ward that have substance abuse issues. I also go downtown to here in Salt Lake to the Rio Grande, and I hand out clean needles to people who are still using. And I do that for a reason. I do that because I want to offer them some hope. I want them to understand that they don't need to continue to put themselves at risk just because they're using. They need to be able to have the option of a clean needle so that they don't come, you know, 12 years into their recovery with hepatitis C or with AIDS or with something. And myself, I've been very fortunate. I've not contracted any of those lovely things, but I had an education. I'm a former nurse in process of getting her license back. I didn't lose it because of my disease. I lost it because I had a sick child. But the good news is we can recover. And with the right education within the church and within our culture, I believe that if the lines of communication can stay open and, like, the bishops can be educated and the stake presidents, the Relief Society presidents, I believe that if we open up those lines of communication and teach people that drug addicts are not bad people, they're sick people. Like if you have cancer or diabetes, we're ill, and we just want to get better. So that's basically all I've got to say. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Ryan. I'm an addict. Driving up here, I counted, and I've said that no less than 5,000 times by my math in the last few years. And I still feel just a little twinge of shame. It's still a little bit hard to say, and I think that's significant, at least for me. I'm really grateful for all the presenters here. They've said a lot of things that I would have liked to say. So instead, maybe I'll just tell you my story. I grew up in Orem, in a very LDS household, very believing, very functional, white, upper middle class, privileged, graduated from seminary. I forsook a scholarship to BYU and went to Utah State before I served a faithful mission. And then I repented and came back and transferred to BYU. And a year later, I was married in the temple, and I was an Elders Quorum president, and I was looking forward to finishing up my degree in economics at BYU and then going to medical school. And over the next 2 or 3 years, life got really, really hard. It was really, really hard to be married. I think everybody who gets married understands that or is in a partnership. And I don't think it was harder for us than anybody else, but it was really hard. And that was the first time that I remember starting to feel ashamed or starting to feel bad, like maybe something was wrong with me. I was doing everything I was supposed to, going to church and reading scriptures and praying and going to the temple and doing all those things that our church leaders tell us to do. And for some reason, it wasn't working. And for some reason, we weren't happy. And those feelings of shame and guilt and pain grew and mounted. And for the previous 25, 26 years, things had gone so well for me, and I had become so good at projecting this image of perfectionism that I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to talk with it. Fast forward past a few punctuated events in our marriage, but I was 27 years old, had never had a drink or a drug in my life, and I got myself to the point where I was standing over my kitchen sink ready to drink some vodka for the first time because I'd heard or seen on TV or talked to other people that said this is a way to get away from the pain. And it was a borderline spiritual experience for me, and I don't mean that facetiously. I mean that in 10 minutes, some alcohol numbed away all the terrible feelings I'd had for going on 3 or 4 years now in a way that it felt like church and prayers and scripture study and all those things weren't able to do. The unfortunate flip side to that is the next morning, I felt even worse. I felt incredibly ashamed about sinning and about taking that easy way out and about trying to get numb. And so I threw away the rest of the bottle, and I promised myself that I would never, ever do that again, and I didn't for about a month. And then, life was hard again, and that numbing had been worn off for 29 and a half days, and things weren't better in my marriage. Things weren't better in other aspects of my life. And I remembered how easy that was and how good that felt, and I did it again. I got drunk again, and it worked. I mean, again, for at least a couple hours, I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel bad. I didn't feel ashamed. I didn't feel numb. I didn't feel hurt. Till the next morning. And it was even worse. Twice as bad, three times as bad. The kind of shame that I felt about not being a perfect person or not being able to live up to the ideals that I thought were supposed to make me happy. And again, threw away the bottle, dumped it out, promised myself that wouldn't happen again. And it didn't for probably about a month. And that pattern kind of continued. I finished BYU lying and hiding, afraid to talk about it, afraid to tell anybody. I moved to Ohio to go to medical school, and problems in my marriage didn't get better. Problems in my mind didn't get better. The rest of my life got a lot more stressful. And throughout the next 3 to 4 years, my drinking pattern got worse, and I actually graduated to pills because then nobody can smell the alcohol, and so you don't have to feel ashamed. But I did, of course. And I got on terrible binge and purge cycles where I would binge and feel awful and feel ashamed and quit and promise myself I'd never do it again. My wife knew and found out, and I talked with the bishop, and he knew and found out. And I couldn't stop. I didn't drink every day. I didn't even drink every week or every 2 weeks. Sometimes it was only once a month, but the compulsion was still there. I always remembered what it felt like to feel okay, and I couldn't find a way to feel okay outside of substances. Somewhere in there, we must have had some happy times, or at least decided that having a child maybe would fix our problem. So we had a baby. I graduated medical school, did really, really well. Somehow was still able to function as a person, probably because I was only, you know, drinking or taking pills every 3 or 4 weeks. And moved to North Carolina to start residency. And again, marriage didn't get better. Child made it harder. I'm working myself into a faith crisis at that point, and life got incredibly more stressful, gone from spending 60, 70 hours a week to 90 to 100 hours a week working or seeing patients. By the end of my first year of residency, our marriage was so bad, and I was drinking or using so consistently that my wife and I separated for the first time. She took our pretty young daughter and left, which, you know, feeling like it was all my fault because I was ashamed because I was drinking and using but still wasn't ready to confront that I was an addict or an alcoholic or however you want to say that. Seeing the bishop pretty regularly, still not able to stop. When she left and she took our child, everything immediately got incredibly worse, and the shame was overwhelming, and it was less than 2 days before I had a DUI, and less than a week after that before the medical board in North Carolina sent me to treatment. So I went to treatment for 90 days. I know what they probably told me. I don't remember hearing it or remember them saying it. I remember that entire 90 days feeling ashamed, really, feeling there's something wrong with me. I have this moral failure. That somehow I can't choose to do the right thing. I can't choose to be a good person no matter how hard I try. And I'm a pretty competent person. I, you know, finished college and had done a lot of things and gone to medical school and was very competently seeing patients. And there was something inside of me that couldn't avoid this sin. And I figured that I must be broken. And so I spent that time at rehab, and I spent the next 6 months after leaving rehab kind of doubling down, not talking, not telling people, learning how to hide it better, learning how to stuff all the pain and the emotions down inside again, so that outwardly I could look like I was functioning okay, look like I was doing well. And that worked until it didn't work anymore. I think I lasted probably about 6 months that time before I relapsed. And started taking pills again. Maybe 6 months after that, marriage got to the point that it just wasn't functional anymore. And my wife and I separated for good with a plan to get divorced. And this is it's probably where I reached my kind of lowest point, in particular in relation to, you know, the LDS concept of marriage and eternal marriage. Here I was not able to do it. Just not able to make the choice to do the right thing, to be the good person that God wanted me to be. And again, despite having been to treatment and despite all the medical background and training and understanding of the neurobiochemical pathways, my concept was still that I was a bad, dysfunctional person inside, and there was no way for me to get better. compound this on something that's already been addressed. I was a physician at the time, seeing patients very regularly, people who trusted me to evaluate them and treat them and listen to my advice. And they didn't know that on the inside I was broken and falling apart and thinking that I really didn't have much to offer besides those things. February 24th, 2015 is when things really got to the worst point. I came to the final conclusion that there wasn't a way for me to get better. I didn't realize that, and again, with all this medical training and all this chemistry knowledge, I didn't realize or didn't accept that I had a disease. I thought there was something wrong with me as a person, something wrong with my morality. And I decided that that was it. There was no hope. There was just no way to get better. And so I attempted suicide. So the topic I was supposed to address, that's already been touched on, maybe I'll just reinforce, is this fairly new theory, maybe the last 20 years or so, that addiction is a disease. And in addiction medicine and in treatment and in therapy, we talk about this disease model of addiction. And if I was given the same presentation that I give to some of the patients, clients, residents that I work with now, I have a lot of slides about dopaminergic pathways and dopamine deficits in neurosynaptic clefts and the mesolimbic pathway and its reward and survival system and how much drugs light that up. We have a lot of slides of functional MRI studies that show that people with addiction, people who are addicted, the actual structure and function of their brain visibly changes from other people when they take and use drugs. And there's a mounting, expanding base of quality evidence that there really are physical and biochemical changes in people who are addicts. But beyond those slides and maybe beyond the evidence, it's probably more important to say that I wanted to stop. I didn't want to hurt myself. I didn't want to hurt people I loved. I didn't want to be what I thought was a bad person, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't not do it. I didn't know how. And the only thing I can compare it to, and this actually plays into some of those mesolimbic pathways and survival mechanisms, is I got to the point where every few weeks I would feel like I couldn't breathe. I feel like I was drowning. And the need that somebody would have if your head was held underwater to pull your head out and take a breath is the need that I had to get away from that pain and get away from that shame. And it really came down to those drugs kicking on as a survival mechanism for me. I thought I would not make it. And I even made the conscious decision that I'm done with that. It's not worth even surviving in this state. It also gives us, I guess, a clue into how we can get better and how we can help. With that knowledge that addiction is a disease and that there are physical and biochemical changes in those that are addicts, it doesn't relieve us of the choices we make and the hurt that we cause and the pain that we inflict on those around us. But it gives us a paradigm to work within that maybe it's not a moral failure on our parts. Maybe we're not broken spiritually, maybe not broken emotionally. Sure, my body is different than yours if you're not an addict. My brain looks different. It reacts to drugs and reacts to dopamine different. There is a difference in me, but it's the same kind of difference as somebody who has diabetes or somebody who has cancer. It's a difference that can be managed. And the way we can manage that is by giving people a safe place to talk about those things, and a safe place to work through that shame, and a way to feel like that they're way to feel that they're not broken, that they're not unfixable, that they're not stuck this way forever, that there's some hope. I obviously did not complete suicide, or I wouldn't be here today. I spent the next few months. I went after attempting suicide. I went to treatment again, and this time I paid really close attention And somehow they were able to reach me. And it was people who had the same problems that I did that were able to talk about the same feelings that I could talk about, that could understand why I felt like I needed drugs or why I felt like I needed alcohol to survive or why I felt like I needed to get away from that pain to survive. And spending another 90 days and then all the time I could after that with people who were understanding and accepting, held me accountable and held boundaries, but realized that I have a disease is really what made the difference. I don't see patients right now. I'm hopefully going to get a license here soon, as soon as I feel like I'm ready. I work at a local treatment center, teaching workshops about the disease model of addiction. I spend time in their process groups and time with them at night talking about these types of things and hopefully giving them some hope and helping them feel like they can get better. I get to spend a lot of time with my kids. My ex-wife now and I have a significantly better relationship. I have a much better relationship with my parents than I did before when they said some of the same things. Pray, repent, why can't you just be better? I let go of some of the things that, for me, I felt like induced the shame. Sometimes the institutionalized concept of worthiness present in the temple recommend process was something I had a hard time with. But really just finding people to talk to, and finding a way to be okay with who I am because I know that I'm not a moral failure, is how I got better. And so if there's one technical thing I want to share with you guys is there's a lot of evidence that addiction is a disease. And your loved ones, even though they make choices that hurt themselves and hurt you, it's not because they're a moral failure or that something is wrong with them spiritually. It's because they have a disease. And that doesn't absolve them from their choices, but it gives a paradigm to work in where we can get better. And the way to help with that is creating safe places, creating understanding, talking about these things instead of ignoring it, trying to create a place where we don't have to be perfect. Helps attack that shame piece. I think that's probably about all I have to share. Give the time back to you. Thanks.
So we have about 20 minutes for a question and answer period. Before we go into that, I want to just address one more myth. And that is the treatment doesn't work. And what we do know is treatment does work. And I'm trying to give you a message of hope. I think every one of us, hopefully, have given you a message of hope for yourself or your loved ones that are struggling with this issue. It does work. There is help available. There's not one model that works for everybody. But I'm a believer that anybody can get help, and anyone can get sober with the right kind of help and care. So I'm going to open this up. If you have any questions, stand up and ask any one of us or us all generally your question. We'll do our best to answer. Yes.
Okay. She has a PhD in addiction recovery, and she has a 75% success rate with her program. And she says that the basis is a nutritional problem. And part of it is the lack of omega-3 fatty acids. When they put these addicts on a nutritional program, marvelous things happen. Prisoners don't go back to prison. There's a better rate of staying out of prison. Addicts don't go back to whatever they're addicted to. Somebody else has a same kind of a program, and she has a 95% success rate. And so I wonder if that is something that has ever been addressed in any of the programs that you've been to.
Who wants to address this? Yeah.
I'll just talk about it. I've been to a couple of treatment programs, and I think each time, and I actually work currently in a treatment program, and each time I think they do an excellent job of taking a whole body approach to treatment. Certainly in the throes of active addiction, our nutrition is not excellent. I'm relatively familiar with the research, and I'm relatively certain that most of that research doesn't really control very well for excluding 12-step based therapy in group therapy, and so it's not like they're testing a purely nutritional program without a therapy component against just a therapy component. And so probably some more research needs to be done about whether just a nutritionally based program would work, but what currently out there exists, that's not the case.
Yeah, I would also say there's not one silver bullet here for addiction. There's multiple causalities of addiction, and therefore there's not just one type of treatment that works. Certainly nutrition is a really important aspect of it, but you know, for some people, they go to 12-step programs and that's great, and some people hate 12-step programs and it doesn't work at all, and therapies and family therapies and trauma and pain management and all these issues play into addiction treatment. It's a very complicated issue. So
my question is, what is the first step? I have a brother, and I know that he has been addicted. And he lives in a small town in Utah. I think that the doctors are on to him because I think that they stopped giving him medication. And so now he self-medicates purely with alcohol, and I don't know if he is able to get pills somewhere else. But I don't even know the first step of how to help him at this point, and he's in his 60s.
That one will work.
Is that working now?
Yes, I turned it on.
I think, pardon me?
Hold it close.
I'm Liz again. I think the first step would be for you to just openly communicate. Go approach it with love. Approach him with love and not judgment. I think that for those of us who live in active addiction for so long, and especially as we get older, we have this certain idea of how life is supposed to be, and we're not measuring up. So if you would just, if you could just approach him and say, you know what, I love you, you're my brother, I'm concerned about you. This is what I've noticed. And don't make it judgmental, don't make it accusatory. Just keep, you know, be very open-minded, and don't do the audible breathtaking when he responds. Don't go, please don't do that, okay? That audible intake of breath brings the shame and the guilt and everything to the forefront, and we shut down. So open communication. I'm a firm believer in you can talk about anything if you do it with love.
Any other, before we go there, any other responses?
I think the more we listen, you know, the more we help. It's not about us lecturing them. It's about being heard or letting them.
I heard another young lady's talk earlier in this day that identified shame culture, a lot of shame aspects in Utah culture and perfectionism and feeling guilt and feeling inadequate. And she took drugs because she just couldn't make the pain go away, and that got her bliss as long as it lasted. I want to ask you if you ever discovered what was eating you, why you felt you were unhappy. Did you feel you didn't measure up? Were you not able to talk about your feelings or consider that life isn't white and black? And whatever you have to say about that, I wouldn't be interested.
Ryan again. Obviously, that sounds a lot like the story I just told, and that's exactly how I felt. If I would have had more time, I probably would have said a piece about the shame culture, and how I didn't learn in my family or in my culture to talk about things that were hurtful or things that I was embarrassed of. And whether this was an explicit or an implicit message, I felt like I had to be perfect. And the things that I didn't do perfectly, I felt like I had to hide. And the pain that that caused eventually turned into something I could only cover with drugs, which was a shameful act. And I felt more shame and more pain and could only cover that with drugs. And it was a terrible cycle. What did I feel like? It's hard to say for real. Probably the most intimate thing I attached to it, and just to be frank, is the idea that I couldn't maintain a celestial marriage. And then after that, sometimes, like I said, the temple recommend process, this kind of institutionalized, codified piece of paper that said you are or you are not worthy, was really hard for me. Really hard for me, just to point out two specific things. And I wouldn't say that that's an explicit message, but somehow, because of the way I was raised, that's what I heard, and it hurt.
Thanks. You know, if any of you have read The Little Prince, when he goes and visits the other planets and then he visits the Tippler, it's the same thing. The Tippler is drinking to forget that he's shameful, and he's shameful because he's drinking. It's a great metaphor of addiction, a great description, I should say.
First, thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your stories. I really appreciate it. I had two questions. One, I was curious about if it's harder to be in healthcare and deal with your addiction. And then my second question is our healthcare community in Utah and nationwide, what are they doing? I get so incredibly angry because I have addiction issues with my family, and why are they allowed, I guess? Why are my family members allowed to continue in this? Does that make sense where I'm going?
So, all right. That's a fantastic question. personally, for me, it was really hard being in healthcare while being an addict. Like the letter I'd written to my wife that I haven't read since I wrote it, but withdrawing or jonesing or being in the addict world, it's called dope sick. It's when you don't have your drugs and you're miserable. Being dope sick, but putting on a tie and a happy face and pretending to care about the person in front of me was super hard. After getting clean, I was working for a hospice pharmacy, so we took care of people who were dying, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't keep dispensing medications to people that I knew were killing them or that it was poisoning them. So I've left that side of pharmacy year and a half ago, and now I'm doing different things. But the other question, that's great. What's healthcare doing? So the CDC just published new guidelines for pain medication, and they say that you should not, under any circumstances, unless it's cancer or another documentable condition, you should never prescribe more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents per day. So in oxycodone terms, that's 60 milligrams of oxycodone per day from all sources. That's the max safe dose that's being recommended. They're shutting pill mills down across the country. They're closing pharmacies now if you're non-compliant. People are losing their licenses. Doctors and pharmacists are going to jail. A big piece of this whole mess. So in 1980, there was a letter to the editor in the New England Journal of Medicine, where this one hospital system said that they had treated, I think, 11,000 patients in the hospital with narcotics, and they'd only had four instances of drug abuse. So opiates clearly must be safe. But they were in the hospital. It's not like they were out on the street, but that article has been cited hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times as a reason to just use them freely. And about that time, prescription rates skyrocketed. The AMA, the American Medical Association, identified pain as a what do you call them? like equivalent to taking blood pressure or temperature. Your pain score was on that level. It's not anymore. Then I'll say you shouldn't even ask anymore. So I think, you know, multifactorial just became a mess. But there are being measures taken to kind of right the ship. So.
I think I'll be a little more cynical and say I think there's a lot to be said about, you know, big pharma that pushes these medications. I think doctors get quite a bit of kickbacks. So, you know, I think it's the number one go-to drug when you go to see your physician. They say, are you feeling bad? Well, here's some Percocets. You're having a headache, you're having migraines, we'll throw, you know, Percocet at you, or hydrocodone. And so I think there's definitely a dark underbelly to it all. I believe that. I think there's a lot of big money and a lot of big pharma that pushes it, and it did start out. It started out with, this is a drug that's not going to hurt you. This is a drug that's not going to be a problem. And even though we know it's a problem, it's still our number one go-to. So there has to be something there.
And I'm going to be the devil's advocate. I've had the extreme good fortune to work with a set of doctors who don't prescribe like that. They recognize the component. They're advocates for clean living. They give when we have an addict come in and withdrawals to our hospital, they give them 7 to 10 days of a Subutex or a Suboxone taper, and then they're done. And if they're on anything else, we do a med wash, and they encourage active recovery. So it's starting to change. But back in the day, when I first had my nursing license and I had keys to the med closet, let me just tell you, cocaine was right there. And I could draw it up and I could use it. And it was great. So.
I just have just one other thought. Quality measures in reimbursement are tied to patient surveys. And patient surveys are what the patients say about their experience. And people want to feel good, and Percocet makes them feel good. And so sometimes there's an ulterior motive there. And in really specifically in emergency medicine, staffing contracts are tied to a survey called the Press-Ganey survey that is really, it's completely weighted towards how the patient fills out a survey about how they felt about their visit. And there's no way to address whether the physician did the correct thing. It only talks about how the patient feels about what happened, which is complicating.
Okay, so my question is, how do you draw a line between being lovely and accepting towards your family member who's struggling with addiction, but they just don't recognize they are, no, I'm not addicted, I just get drunk once in a while, but then when they do, they go and assault someone and go to court, and I mean, it's a mess. So I'm talking about my own daughter. I mean, she doesn't acknowledge that she has a problem that needs to be addressed and treated. And then I look at my grandson and I want to help them, but if I do help, she's going to have extra money to get drunk and do marijuana. So how do you navigate that? I have no idea. I mean, I want to show that I care and that I love them, but if I help too much, I'm going to be actually enabling that kind of behavior. So what do you guys have to say about that?
Thank you. That's about every DCFS conversation I've ever been in, is how do we support someone without enabling, or was this family member enabling? I think, and it kind of goes back to that, you know, I think the best thing you can do as a parent is it's not your job to fix them. It's your job to be there to listen to them, support them, care about them. If they need a meal, you know, you can help them get a meal. You don't have to give them money, but it's being there for, in that moment when they're ready to really ask for help. And be there in that moment when they come to you, and being open to that when they're ready. But coming to them and lecturing and causing, you know, it's just going to fall on deaf ears at that point. But being ready for when they come to you would be my advice.
I'm also going to say that this is also the job for professionals. There's a lot of professionals that deal with addiction and help families exactly in your situation. Like, how do we approach our loved one in a loving and supportive way without enabling? And you know, professionals are there to help you navigate the whole situation. So don't be afraid to get help. You know, you don't have to do this alone.
There were two comments that I found particularly just really impressive, that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it is community and support, and that Mormons are more prepared for natural disasters than addiction. So putting those two together, it seems like we have a really good tool, we're just not prepared to use it. So I'd appreciate it if you could put yourselves in a position of leadership at either a local level or at the general level where you have all the deciding power. What would be the decision that you would recommend the church make, locally or generally, to become prepared and really use the tool that we have at our disposal?
It's loaded, I know.
As a recovering Mormon, I've had a really interesting relationship with the church for years. And what has turned the tide for me personally was the fact that I have family members who, number one, accept me no matter what, and they encourage open communication. What has changed for me as far as my church affiliation is that I've had a couple of bishops that have actually been open-minded to the fact that we're not all cut from the same cloth, and that we all don't do the same things. And it's left that door open for me to find my way. It still goes back to communication for me. I truly, truly believe that if we put aside our judgments and the requirements for our temple recommend, you know, we don't view each other as whether or not they're temple worthy. We view each other as human beings, okay? First and foremost, who cares if you've got a temple recommend? I'm sorry, I don't. That's not my criteria for me to be a friend to you. My criteria is whether or not you want to be a friend to me. And even if you don't, I'm still going to reach out my hand, because I truly, truly believe that if we come from a place of acceptance rather than judgment, you know, then it leaves that door open and people will find their way. Like I said, I've been very fortunate. I have a bishop right now that's absolutely awesome. And I can go in and visit with him. I can call him. I can not show up to church for months on end, which my job, you know, I can't always get to church because I work graveyards. So, you know, sometimes I just don't make it. But I'll show up, and the thing is he hasn't pushed, and he hasn't been in judgment, and he hasn't said, well, you can't go downtown and hand out clean needles. That's not what we do. He said that's important. He recognized that in my world, that's important. And he acknowledged that that was something that I needed to do. And he didn't, you know, there wasn't that, oh my gosh, what are you doing? That's horrible. That's important. So I think communication, I think that if we could all maybe step up a little bit and approach our ecclesiastical leaders with part of a solution, or even, you know, just open the door of communication, I truly believe that that would help alleviate a lot of the guilt and shame, because the LDS church is steeped in tradition, and if you don't fit that mold, then you're screwed. And I'm sorry, I'm tired of being screwed. I'd much rather be participant and be a part of than be on the outside looking in. So
you know, my first AA meeting I went to,
When it was over, this guy named Dave came up to me. I'd never seen him before in my life. He must have recognized me as a new guy. He put his arm around me and he said, "Hey, Jeff, I'm glad you're here." And he took me downstairs in this building and got me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the fact that he would reach out to me like that, didn't matter what my story was, didn't matter that I had substance abuse problems, I've been an addict, and none of that mattered. It was just, "Hey, Jeff, I'm glad you're here." So I wonder if maybe taking the bishop or clergy out of it altogether when it's stuff like this, you know, if you're an addict or you're dependent on a drug, either you made a bad decision or you trusted a doctor and you ended up hooked. You're not a sinner. Why does it have to go through the bishop? And bishops got enough on their plate anyway. I've been hoped to never be one, but, you know, tithing and fast offerings and all that other nonsense, they just don't have the time, they don't have the resources, they don't have the education, and many of them probably don't have the experience. So I don't know why. I would, if it were up to me and I could smack a gavel, move it away from that altogether and try to have just a community within the church or the ward or the stake where if you feel like you need help, you can go and they will just tell you, "Hey, we're glad you're here. And if you want to work out the details of your specifics of your story, you can. And if not, you're still going to be welcome either way." But
I agree. Just bring it out of the darkness, bring it into the light. Let's be more aware. Let's be more compassionate to other people that are struggling with this. Understand that they're not sinners. They're not evil. Their body's reacting the way their body's supposed to react to these things, and they need help to change it back to its, you know, pre-addiction state.
I'm gonna add one thing. 30 years ago, the church didn't know what to do with sexual abuse that happened inside the church. It was all hush-hush. It was not attended to. Since then, the leadership has really developed this, a lot of training for bishoprics and leadership of the church. There's a hotline. There's all these resources available. And I wish that we could get that same sort of resources and community from top down. But I'll tell you how it happened is people in the local congregation started making noise. And that's why these resources were created. And so I think we as a community, if we're making noise in our local congregations, I think that will eventually get heard. I think there is noise being made now. And the more noise we make, the more resources and the more community we're going to have to help people with addiction. It is past 6:30, so I want to officially close the session, but I'm going to stay up. I don't know. I imagine most, if not all of us, will be willing to stay up and continue to answer questions and give whatever help and support we have. I'd want to remind you, I do have a little handout that, you know, help for families, if that's helpful. And thank you very much.